Red Line.
Welcome to Radio Sputnik and its weekend program, The Red Line, with me, Sergei Strokin. Welcome to today's program, and this is what we want to highlight as the news-breaking stories of the week that proved to be extremely tense, dramatic, and tragic. Brussels attack. Blowing up the pan-European home. A string of deadly attacks in Brussels, the biggest in the history of Belgian capital, unveiled major loopholes in the security system and spread panic throughout the European continent by putting the rest of it on high alert. John Kerry in Moscow, knocking at the Kremlin's door. Secretary of State John Kerry flew to Moscow to discuss Syria and Ukraine with Russia's President Vladimir Putin following a breakthrough ceasefire agreement on Syria. And also, Barack Obama, setting foot in the Cuban no-go zone. President Obama paid a landmark visit to Cuba, symbolically proving that isolation and sanction policy never work and must come to an eventual end. But despite euphoria over the visit, both sides still strongly differ on human rights and the definition of freedom. So let us come to our first section beyond the headlines to speak about the spree of bombings that rocked Brussels. A string of deadly attacks in Brussels, which were the biggest in the history of the Belgian capital, unveiled major loopholes in the security system and spread panic throughout the European continent. Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack, and it comes just days after one of the Paris masterminds was apprehended in the city. The terrorist bombings were spread all throughout the city, targeting the airport and a handful of metro stations, ultimately claiming the lives of over 30 victims and leading to at least 250 casualties. European leaders have spoken loudly about how the continent is now at war and how the attack was also against the EU's freedoms. While Europe on edge and Brussels in a sea of blood, it's anyone's guess what will come next. So, and this is the topic which we will discuss with our studio guest. Let me welcome in the studio Mr. Fyodor Vaitilovsky, Deputy Director of Institute of World Economy and International Relations with Russia's Academy of Sciences. Mr. Vaitilovsky, thank you for coming on Redline.
Hello, I'm very glad to be here.
So we really had a tragic week this time, and I think we have to start with voicing condolences to the victims and condemning terrorism in all strongest terms. You remember how we witnessed in Moscow also a number of attacks. I remember how my daughter narrowly escaped attack at Park Kultury metro station several years ago. So it shows that all of us are in the same boat. But Mr. Vaitilovsky, I was thinking of the symbolism of the dates. They was before this week, they was September 11. And now we also have another date, which is March 22. We had terrorist attack America was facing 15 years ago, because this year we are just having this 15th anniversary of the attack. And now we have this attack in Europe. So why is it that despite such efforts are made to wipe out terrorism, it's only growing, and there's no end to that?
I think that now Europe is much more vulnerable than the United States for any terrorist attack. Because after 9/11, the United States invested a lot of money and efforts into building national security system and protecting major cities of the United States, into developing system of control, into developing national security agency capabilities to protect people in the United States. But what have been done on the European level, I think that efforts were much smaller. They were incomparable to American. And after Patriotic Act 1 and Patriotic Act 2, the United States also received legal background for fighting terrorism on their own territory. But what the European Union has NATO protection. But NATO is an absolutely different thing. The alliance is much less prepared for new forms of challenges to national security of its members, and it's less prepared also for cooperation on non-traditional security threats. It's much more still aimed to Cold War stereotypes and to state-to-state, you know, confrontation than to protecting people from terrorist attacks.
You know that Islamic State terrorist group, which is known in the Arab world as Daesh, has claimed responsibility for Brussels attacks. And in fact, Daesh carried out a number of attacks across the world from Paris to Ankara in recent months. So this is the global phenomenon. Luckily, Americans, well, they were able to at least resolve this problem within the country. But security for one means insecurity for the others, as Kissinger said. Look at the Middle East, look at Europe. Don't you think that probably this is a moment of truth for all of us? We have to understand that we have to put aside all the differences. We should not be involved in blame game, in sanctions war, and we have to raise against terrorism.
Of course, and we shouldn't underestimate this real threat to international security, to security of all responsible members of international community. I remember when in the beginning of Arab Spring, a lot of politicians, experts and officials in the European Union were so excited with the spread of freedom and democracy in its Western standards in the Middle East, that they supported any position of Washington, D.C. on these issues. They were so excited that they were saying that it doesn't matter who is bringing democracy to the Middle East. And they also were saying a lot about whatever allies they have on the initial step, on the initial level of developing democracies. The result is much more significant than the means they were using for it. And in that time, I remember a lot of people in Brussels, in Paris, in London, and in Ankara were saying that why not Muslim radicals? Why not to support them if they are fighting against dictators in the Middle East? So now we have results. And I think that France, Turkey, Britain, and, of course, European bureaucracy and the Euro-Atlantic bureaucracy in Brussels invested a lot to this process of supporting radical forms of political unrest in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Brussels, but the bitter irony is that despite such investments in Brussels, it seems that even this attack has taken Brussels by surprise. Let us hear from Brussels. Now we have a guest on the line from Brussels, James Drew, political editor of EU Reporter, who was closely to the place of the terrorist attacks.
Red Line.
James, after the emotional shock of it all wore off, was this really a big surprise for Europe? Or was it somehow expected in a way, and why?
Okay, well, fundamentally, I don't think it was a big surprise to anybody in Brussels or Belgium. Since the people were arrested quite recently, in fact, just before last weekend, the alleged suspects of the Paris attacks were arrested, people have been expecting something like this to occur in Brussels. I think the point is that they were not expecting it on this scale. Obviously, nobody knew what would happen. The number of dead and the number of injured, I don't think anybody expected it to be this to this extent.
And how long do you think these attacks were planned for? Were they devised before the Paris mastermind was captured, or were they just an impromptu but very effective reaction to his arrest?
It's a difficult one to answer that. I believe when you consider the fact that there are clearly numerous cells now dotted around Europe of jihadists and others, I would suggest there would have been a little bit of forward planning. But some of the evidence that has now reached the intelligence services and the police in Brussels, one of the bombers apparently left a note at his house saying, "Everybody's looking for me. I'm going to be put in a cell." And he left that note and then he went out and did it. I get the impression that this attack was perhaps to a certain extent, for want of a better word, impromptu. But I would imagine that an attack would have been planned for some time, yes, since Paris.
It seems to many observers that Brussels just all of a sudden became this big terrorist hotspot. How did it get that way?
Now you're asking me, and I wonder if I'm able to answer that question. How did it get that way? I suppose it's because of the fact that, as the intelligence services know, since Paris, there have been a number of people based in the area of Brussels called Molenbeek that were planning towards these kind of attacks. And so they must have been in place for some time. But I think the interesting thing is that these people would be also of Belgian origin. I mean, they were maybe not Belgian born, but they were certainly of Belgian origin. They had lived here for a long time, and they were of their own causes, but they were of Belgian origin. So therefore, quite frankly, further than that, I just don't know. I mean, I don't suppose anybody will know. Most of them are dead now. it's always difficult, isn't it, in these sort of situations. You don't tend to ask the perpetrators afterwards because they normally are dead.
James, and what steps can European authorities take to reverse this process?
Well, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? What can you do? When you have people who are prepared to die to strap explosives to themselves and then blow themselves up for their cause, for their perverted cause, what can you do? I mean, you can't shut everything down forever, can you? You can't shut airports down forever. You can't shut train stations down forever. So what are the intelligence services expected to do when you're faced with people who are prepared to take their own lives, to take out other people's lives? I really don't know. I suppose there will be an increase in security, I'm sure, at the airports now. I think what will probably happen, certainly at Zaventem, is that maybe people will be security checked before they even enter the airport. But I mean, how much time, how much stress, how much kind of, how many problems is that going to cause? And how possible is that for any sort of organization to carry on a daily, weekly basis? I mean, airports have to maintain a certain amount of movement, don't they? They can't have people queuing up outside the airports. So further than that, again, I don't really know. I suppose, the best that they can do is start increasing security. But I don't know how long that will last.
Thank you, James, for that insight. And I hope that Brussels would just overcome that. Please rest assured that all of us are with you. Red Line. So, and now we have another guest on the line, who is Gilbert Mercier, author of The Aurelian Empire and editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post. Mr. Gilbert, Brussels has exposed as a terrorist nest over the past year or so. It was sending many fighters to Daesh and been the safe haven where the Paris attacks were plotted. So I'm just wondering, how did the same city which hosts the EU and NATO headquarters turn into such an internationally dangerous place?
It has been going on for actually decades. It's been a very slow process. What people have to understand is there has been, not only in Belgium, but all across Europe, an ideological, if you wish, push of Saudi Arabia since 1960, when they built the Grand Mosque in Brussels. The mosque in question are usually run by Salafist imams. Now, what Saudi Arabia is also doing, Saudi Arabia, through Muslim charities, is doing a distribution of food in poor Arab populated areas, such as a hotspot in Belgium itself, which is Molenbeek. Now, it's also a factor of geographic positioning of Belgium, which sit between France, Germany, and the Netherlands. Brussels, to give your listener an idea, is only 2 hours away by train from Paris, from Rotterdam, and from Dusseldorf, which is all very, very convenient. Now, there's also a symbolic, of course, aspect of the attack, because this is the capital of the EU. And that's a message. The Daesh Islamic fighter are sending a message to Europe saying, well, any country is no fair game for radicalized Islamists. Now, there's also a factor which is very important, and it's a factor of society, and that concerns not only Belgium, but all Europe. There's an exclusion of young Arabs, which are usually, I mean, now some of them are even third generation, so their own parents were born either in Belgium, France, Germany, and so on. And the economic factor is that the unemployment rate among those population, those fraction of population, is more than 25%. Now, when idle young men, they get recruited in the mosque. And eventually, because they don't have any possibility of work, they opt that is to be recruited as fighters, Islamist fighters, and they are transiting from Belgium or elsewhere in Europe through different channels. There's a lot of those guys that go to Dusseldorf who offer very, very cheap flight to Turkey. And Turkey, since Turkey has become, closer to the fundamentalists, then they go and fight in Syria or Iraq or wherever else. there's also a factor that nobody mentioned. A lot of weapons are available in Belgium, and there's a role that has been played mainly by Albanian gangs, but also Chechen gangs since the 90s. And they funnel a large amount of weapons to Belgium. So it's very easy to get guns. For example, the attack in Paris, which was a lot bloodier, killed more than 130 people. All the weapons were actually coming from Belgium and probably trafficked originally by Albanian gangs.
We are running out of time, and just to wrap it up, I think that our discussion revealed that the Brussels attack should be seen in a broader context of global jihadists stepping up attacks on civilians around the world, and the world has to race to this challenge. So let me thank all our guests, beginning with Mr. Fyodor Vaitilovsky, Deputy Director of the Institute of World Economy and International Relations, then James Drew, Production Editor of EU reporter from Brussels, and Mr. Gilbert Mercier, author Orwellian Empire and editor-in-chief of New Junkie Post. Following in our program, we have John Kerry in Moscow, knocking at the Kremlin's door, and also Barack Obama, setting foot in the Cuban no-go zone. Stay with us.